Welcome to the first ever second part of Damsels and Donuts with Devil in Details. We are talking about Robert Hansen, the pain and ass killer who made me want to do two part episodes about how he being a donut maker was killing damsels. So previously till now we have seen how he grew up in his family with his parents, and how he had this stammering problem with very bad acne, being bullied in his school for his appearance, and probably some mistakes that were not of his. But then he just regenerated it into a rage against similar good-looking teenage girls, or were they just an easy victims to get away with? Well, both of a bit. And we also see that how Robert Hansen was ironically arrested for trying to steal a chainsaw, but not raping and murdering call girls or students and many other girls. Up to 5 girls have been murdered till now. So yeah, so moving on, we will be still discussing about Robert Hansen's story, and we'll continue from the last episode about what happened for the rest of his life. Robert had been initially sentenced to 5 years and he served only 1. Also, in 1978, Hansen applied for a pilot's license. On his application, he said he was taking lithium, a drug used to control bipolar disorder. He was denied a license because of this. So this, he just filed a new application, not saying he was on lithium, and did get his pilot's license. You know, things are working around for him. Sweet. There would only be one more legal complaint filed against Hansen from this time until he was eventually tracked down for multiple murders. The lone complaint was filed by yet another prostitute. She claimed that he held her hostage in his camper in Anchorage, and that she had become convicted that Hansen was going to rape and kill her. Nude and desperate, she'd broken a window in trailer and gotten out, running down the street, screaming as she went. The police got involved, but again, nothing came of the case. There was no physical evidence. In 1979, Robert Hansen finds another woman he wants to hurt. On October 14, 1979, Christy Hayes was dancing at Amber's, a club downtown Anchorage. She did a table dance for a fellow who was sitting by himself nursing a beer. He flashed a roll of money and with a stutter asked if they could meet later. "I'll be off in 20 minutes, she told him, and he said, "Good, we will meet outside. Look for a gold camper." Later, after Hess got into back of the camper on an agreement to perform oral sex, Hansen pulled a gun. He forced his victim to strip, then he bound her with the snare wire. Fearing for her life, Christy began to scream, and then Hansen's threat didn't shut her up. They made her more hysterical. Worried that someone would hear the screams and call the police, Hansen jumped out of the back of the camper and into the cab to drive out into the wilderness. As he maneuvered the pickup through the streets of Anchorage to get Glen Highway, Christy managed to squirm out of her bonds. Now, besides screaming, she was pounding on camper walls. Hansen slammed on brakes, causing this poor woman to fall forward and bash her head against camper wall. Hansen then got out and ran around the back of the camper, but he couldn't get in because Christy had locked the camper door. Christy then crawled through the sliding glass window between the camper and the cab and locked the cab doors as well. Unfortunately, the driver's window was rolled partway down and Hansen stuck his arm through to pull up the lock. As fast as she could, Christy then crammed the window up, trapping robots. I'm really loving it, Christy. Fight, Christy. Fight. Hail, Christy. Okay, so enraged Hansen freed his arm by breaking the window. Then he yanked naked Christy out of the cab and threw her on the ground. After getting thrown naked to the ground, Hess bounces back up to her feet and runs down the street. And despite being barefoot, despite getting her head bashed into camper, Hansen can't catch her. He chases her and then gives up after a couple of blocks. Then he runs back into his camper, throws Christy's clothes on the ground and drives off. Naked, with bruised face, which was very bad, Christy Hayes keeps running and screaming for help. She eventually finds someone to help her and reports the assault to police. But she wasn't able to identify her assailant from mugshots or that was provided to her with any of the leads. She got away though. She lived. That same month in October of 79, Hansen picked up a 16-year-old girl outside the Fourth Avenue movie theater and drove her out to the wilderness with the intention to rape her. But when his captive told him she was homeless and hadn't eaten for 2 days, he let her go without assaulting her. Guess he decided she wasn't like the girls who mocked him. Rare moment of humanity for Hansen. He actually took pity on someone. Took pity on a 16-year-old he initially totally wanted to rape. But still, he did one kind of good thing. Later that fall, however, things turned out differently. Hansen cut a deal for a sex with a young woman who would come to be called Ikluna. Annie, thought to have come to Anchorage from Kodiak Island. She was wearing blue jeans, a sweater, brown leather jacket and high-heeled red cuff length zip-up boots. When she got into his gold camper, Hansen would later recall, quote, "I can't remember if she was a prostitute or a dancer. I picked her up downtown and told her I was going to take her to my home. I was heading up to Ikluna Road and there were several offshore roads there." When it became obvious to the woman that Hansen wasn't driving her to his home as he said he would, she told him she wanted to go back. "You're just a little further," he told her. "Well, I'm not," she replied. And then Robert pulled out a gun and pointed at her. "Yes, you are. You do exactly what I say and you won't get hurt." Continuing to north on Glen Highway toward the Knickknack River, he turned off to Ikluna Road, heading towards east toward the Ikluna Lake. Fall rains had combined with summer runoff from Ikluna Glacier to make lakes and streams water levels high, and many of the capillary roads and trails of the main road continued water hazards. The one Robert turned onto did it quickly became a muddy swamp and he got stuck. Robert had to use his winch to try and get his vehicle free, and when working on that, the woman he had kidnapped started to try and sneak off into the woods. He yelled to her to stay put and then she started running. He ran after her and unfortunately she wasn't fast as Christy Hess, and he caught her and grabbed the terrified woman by the hair. Then she reached into her purse and pulled out a big black handled buck knife. She swung her buck knife toward Hansen, but he was able to block the blow and grab the hand that he held the knife. And then he tripped her to the ground. She pleaded, "Don't kill me, don't kill me." And then, while she was on the ground, down he plunged the knife into her back and then buried her, quickly dug a shallow grave. In June of 1980, Roxanne Island, a 24-year-old woman, disappeared from Anchorage, another Hansen victim. 23-year-old Johnson Melissa went missing from Seward in July. Despite the Butcher Baker murders 7 years earlier, beginning in 1973, when Hansen was finally caught, he would initially claim that his first victim was Joanne Messina. Side note about this Joanne is that Joanne Messina, forever known to the troopers as the Bear Lady, This was because when an investigator named John Lucking found her dead body at her hasty grave site, he also found a very alive black bear. Walter J. Gilmore, author of Butcher Baker, the true account of an Alaska serial killer and director of the Trooper Academy in Sitka, wrote this of the incident. Quote, "If you have ever been object to a 200-pound black bear's attention, especially one intent on protecting its food source, you know that these beasts can be troublesome. While some people believe black bears are less dangerous than grizzlies, that's not true in Alaska, and even less true if they are feeding. As Luckily and his fellow investigators stared down the possibility of becoming another link in the food chain, they determined they had better scare the bear away. Scare tactics did not work, though, and the bear became more menacing and protective of its food. They couldn't let the bear destroy their evidence either, so the only logical course was to destroy the bear. The black bear is a protected species in Alaska, so to kill one is tantamount to homicide. The wildlife in Alaska, moreover, have pretty zealous protectors in the form of fish and wildlife police. Also, somewhat derisive known as fish cops. Although it was quickly evident once the bear had taken care of that we had had homicide on our hands, the hue and the cry that was raised focused almost exclusively on Luking's destruction of the hapless bear. Needless to say, that element of the case became an unwanted distraction." Unquote. Such an Alaskan detail, homicide investigators having to deal with a bear and investigators having to deal with the detail of people losing their shit over a bear being killed, people worried about more about that more than a woman. That also feels very Alaskan to me. It would be another 2 years before the troopers got to break in Joanna's homicide, as in 1980 Hansen really began to ramp up his killings in Anchorage area, especially on prostitutes. His MO was pretty consistent. After paying for their services, he would kidnap and rape them, then he would then fly them out to a hunting cabin he had brought in the Knickknack River Valley in his airplane. He would then release his victims into the woods to stalk and kill them either with a hunting knife or a .223 caliber Ruger Mini 14, a semi-automatic weapon similar in appearance to military M16. And while the body count continued to rise, it was hard for the investigators to link all of the deaths to one killer prostitutes who were disappearing from Anchorage all the time. Just not always because they were being killed. Due to the transient nature of many of the people passing through the Anchorage at this time, people popping in to make some quick cash and then back to wherever they lived, it wasn't easy to determine why someone suddenly disappeared, also complicating the investigation. Hansen's rape and murder tactics generally left little to no evidence. In one case, in 1980, he allegedly shot the dog of a woman he had murdered to make sure the dog wouldn't lead anybody to her shallow grave. Horrible. In the fall of 1980, more young women continued to disappear. And again, on September 6, 1980, Lisa Futrell, a 41-year-old white female in last seen Anchorage, and her death will be later traced to Hansen. In January of 1981, Robert opens a new bakery at 9th in Inagra, Anchorage. No reason to let constant killing get in the way of your bakery career. So fucking weird. Murder, rape, and donuts. Who knew they could go together? This has been such a strange episode to research, so keep finding myself both disgusted and also very hungry for donuts. Keep thinking weird shit like that, but I bet he did really, really make good donuts. What a weird thing if you were a detective trying to solve this murders, but also a detective who really, really loved Hansen's donuts. Like, what if he made by far the best donuts in Anchorage, and then you catch him and want to celebrate by grabbing a dozen of fresh donuts? Fuck. I wonder if he can make few more donuts from the prison. Robert got money to open his new bakery by using $13,000 cash settlement he received from a false insurance claim he had made. Huh. Bob had claimed that his home was robbed, that the thieves had stolen his hunting trophies. Allegedly, after the missing hunting trophies were found in his backyard, Hansen said he had just forgot to report the recovery. 1981 was a great year for Bob. Hansen was somehow still happily married to Gloria despite all his past legal problems. He had two healthy kids and a new bakery. His business prospered. He was considered a successful and respected member of the community. Does anyone think life is fair? After hearing about a story like this, can you still think life is fair? Or that karma is real? Also, in 1981, at least two more Alaskan women disappear after Robert rapes and murders them. 22-year-old Andrea Altieri and 23-year-old Anchorage Sherry Murrow. Sherry Murrow had been a dancer in Anchorage for 3 years, bouncing from club to club. The Wild Cherry would be her last booking. Friends described the 5'6" blonde as pretty girl, quiet and shy. Her roommate saw her as a lonely, troubled 23-year-old girl who just wanted to meet the right guy and get married. Quote, "I kept telling her there were only chicks that came into the clubs," her roommate said. Sherry was gullible, easily talked into anything. When Sherry was last seen living a friend's house around noon on November 1981, she was wearing jeans, a baby blue sky jacket, a pair of blue moon boots, an arrow-headed necklace, and a wire-rimmed glass that framed her blue eyes. She was going to Alice's 210 cafe to meet some supposed photographer she had met who was going to pay her $300 for posing nude. Some photographer who smelled like donuts. Shortly after meeting his intended victim at a cafe, Robert Hansen had blindfolded Morrow with ace bandages, and while she knelt handcuffed and helpless on the floorboard on the front seat of his brown Subaru, he drove her to the Nickna River. He eventually turned left Glen Highway, followed a winding road past cultivated potato fields, and then drove through some brush flats and onto a sandbar along the riverbed. Hansen then led Sherry out of the car, but before he could get the handcuffs off her, she started kicking and screaming. Deciding to let her cool off, Hansen took his .223 caliber Mini 14 out of his trunk and then calmly walked over and sat down by a tree while she screamed. Eventually, she ran towards Hansen. Hansen would later say he was sitting on his ass while she stood above him, kicking and screaming, and then, he said, "I just pointed the Mini 14 up towards her and pulled the trigger." Damn. He just loves to toy with them. Hansen, with bruises on his legs from being kicked by Sherry, then took fold-up spade that was part of his murder kit and dug a shallow grave in the slit and the sand. After rolling Marrow's body into the hole, he removed her arrowhead necklace for a souvenir. He loved taking little reminders of his victims. Before he covered over the corpse, he bent down, picked up the spent .223 shell casings and tossed it into the grave. Then he walked back into his car, fondling her necklace. 2 weeks later, he'd collect another trophy. On the morning of December 2nd, Andrea Altieri left her apartment to meet some older men she had just met for shopping spree at Boniface Mall. Some dude who smelled like donuts. Andrea, whose Stage name was Enchantment Danced at Push Company. She hadn't felt suspicious about older men, probably wealthy, taking her to buy nice things, some of the guys who came up to strip clubs, just that sometimes. She'd put on jeans, red sweater, her gold chain with a fish charm on it, a pearl ring, a black leather jacket. She gave her roommate another dancer who went by the stage name of Magic a see you later hug. And then Andrea took a cab to the Boniface Mall and disappeared. And then Robert did to her what he'd done to so many other girls by now. Altree ended up handcuffed and blindfolded, and Hansen drove her to the Nicknor River area. Turning onto the service road off the Palmer Highway, he headed for an isolated spot by the Nicknor River Rail Bridge Road. He told her he'd raped a woman there the week before, and according to Hansen, everything had gone fine and I let her go. Well, she was still in the car. Hansen fondled Altree's breast for a while, as if they were on a consensual date, and then he held a .22 Browning automatic pistol to her head, very undate-like, and he forced her to perform oral sex. Soon, Andrea told him she had to go to the bathroom. They got out of the car and Robert laid his gun on the hood. Andrea walked off a ways to go to the bathroom and Robert kept her did the same. Unzipping his pants and starting to urinate, suddenly Hansen heard the noise and pivoted to see Andrea running back and reaching for the pistol on the car. She managed to get her hand on the butt of the revolver before Hansen got to her so close. She came so close, but Robert grabbed the gun by the barrel, twisted it out of her hand and threw it back onto the hood. Then Andrea started crawling at the acne-scarred face of her assailant, and he snatched the gun off the car and shot her. And then Hansen got canvassed a full bag and folding the shovel out of his car and filled the bag with gravel from the railbed road. After lugging the bag out of the middle of the roadside trestle, he went back for Altree's body. He tied the duffel bag to the dead woman's neck and pushed it and the body off the bridge into the Nicknor. As he walked back into his car, Hansen fondled the pearl ring and fish charm necklace he had taken off his victim's body. Another trophy. Due to booming bakery business in January of 1982, Robert was able to buy himself a new plane, a Piper Super Club. This would be the plane he used for transporting the rest of his victims to his remote cabin on the Nicknor River. His modulus operandi would be now to pick women along 4th Avenue, binding her hands at gunpoint, then flying her out to Nicknor River where he would rape and then decide if he was going to fly her back and let her go or shoot her. The Nicknor River was his favorite killing location. It was still close to town, yet remote enough that he could hunt women without anyone around to hear them. It was also a place with hundreds of sandbars to easily land his plane on, a place to collect more trophies. His den was loaded with dead animal heads from those hunts, while his basement was curing more and more trophies from the human hunts. Thank God he kept these trophies. These trophies would soon help the investigators finally convict him. On May 26th of 1982, another Hansen's victims, Sue Luna, 23, is last seen in Anchorage. Her case was very similar to Sherry Morrow's. Sue met Hansen at a Good Time strip club. Like Sherry Morrow, Sue had agreed to meet Hansen at Alice's 210 Club, another CD spot downtown. Although Luna was not offered money for nude photos, she was paid $300 for an hour for sex. Sue's roommate eventually reported that Luna did not appear for work on May 26th and that she had not been seen since then. And Chu's sister reported her missing. Finally, Anchorage City Police and then Alaskan State Police began to accept that many of the dancers weren't just heading back to wherever they normally lived. Someone was killing them. Many of them. The police realized that since 1986, dancers had disappeared completely from the 4th Avenue clubs. Dancers who had told no one they were leaving town. And Anchorage police quietly formed what they called a dancer task force to look into these disappearances. Then on September 12, 1982, two off-duty police officers were hunting and found a shallow grave under the banks of the Nicknaw River, a possible break in this new case. According to the book Butcher Baker, the two men had little luck hunting, and as darkness began to fall, they decided to call it a day. These guys were cutting across the wild sandbar when they noticed a boot sticking out of the sand. Upon closer inspection, when they saw sticking out of the sand was partially decomposed bone joint. Once their minds registered what they were looking at, both men backed up from the scene. The last thing they wanted to do was to disturb or contaminate any evidence. After making note of the location, both men made their way out of the gorge and back into their camp and then back to Anchorage. Sergeant Rolly Pert had been assigned to cover this investigation. A decorated Vietnam veteran, Pert was considered one of the top investigators on the force. He was meticulous with every crime scene and was known to spend hours going over the smallest area. Before disturbing the body, Pert had the photographs taken from every angle and carefully examined the body itself for a trace of evidence before having it packed. Afterwards, he pulled out a large screen and began sifting through the sand around the body. It took several hours for him to finish sifting, but in the end it paid off. Lying on the screen before him was a single shell casing from a .223 caliber bullet. Pert was familiar with this type of ammunition and knew that it was used in high power rifles like M16s, Mini-14s or AR-15s. Back in Anchorage, a preliminary autopsy report that the victim was a female of undetermined age had been dead for approximately 6 months. The cause of death was three gunshots from .223 caliber bullets. His bandages were found mingled in with remains, causing investigators to suspect that the victim had been blindfolded at the time of death. It took a little over 2 weeks to finally identify the body. Finally. She was, of course, Sherry Morrow, who had been reporting missing from a year earlier. Morrow had been shot in the back 3 times, and the cartridges found near the body suggest that she had been shot with .223 Roger Mini-14 hunting rifle. A strange element to the scene was that although the body was found fully clothed, there were no bullet holes in the clothing. This led the investigators to believe that Sherry had been naked when shot and had been redressed after death. Anchorage police also knew by now that Sherry Morrow's murder was not an isolated incident. However, they didn't want to spread fear or tip off the killer by going public. When discussing Morrow's murder with the Anchorage Daily News, the investigators said that they doubted that it was related to the disappearance of at least three other women since 1980. Quote, "We don't believe we have a mass murderer out there, some psycho knocking off girls," unquote, said Anchorage Police Detective Max Farnell. Privately, they absolutely thought this was the work of some psycho out there knocking off girls, and of course they were very right. Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Lyle Huxman was now assigned to determine whether or not Sherry Morrow's murder was an isolated incident. One theory pursued had Morrow's killer going back and forth between Fairbanks and Anchorage. Another investigator, late Patrick Kensick, later explained this theory. He said, at the same time that dancers were disappearing in Anchorage, evidently to meet the same fate as Sherry Morrow, other women were being killed in Fairbanks. It was natural to take a look at those cases to see if there is any connection. The attempt to establish a link between Fairbanks and Anchorage serial killers was both intensively extensive and expensive. With our investigation relying on some of the most sophisticated computer systems available at the time. In the Fairbanks serial murders, the killer tied the victim's hand behind their backs, and we thought that was a key similarity to Anchorage murders. A high caliber weapon was also used, and Fairbanks killer blew the women's heads off in an attempt to destroy their faces. The bodies were left close to the road, moreover, with no effort to hide them. The FBI psychiatrist told us that there was something ritualistic about the killings, but no apparent connection between the serial murders in Fairbanks and Anchorage. The many computer analysis also told no. There was no concrete link between the killings in two cities. Even the autopsy results pointed in different directions, unquote. In 1982, the Fairbanks killer was identified. His name was Thomas Richard Bundy. Bundy was suspected of killing six women but was never arrested. On the day of his arrest, warrant was issued. He drove his motorcycle into oncoming traffic and killed himself. No one from the other vehicle was seriously injured, and he saved the taxpayers a lot of money by doing that. Thanks, Richard. You did at least one good thing before you died. After realizing Anchorage and Fairbanks murders were not connected, investigators reduced their area of investigative focus to just Anchorage and the surrounding towns. But they still didn't have decent suspect. Then, on April 25, 1983, Hansen stuck again, killing Paula Goldwick, a 17-year-old, and then finally Hansen would slip up and investigators would realize they had found their man. On June 13, 1983, a 19-year-old Anchorage prostitute named Cindy Paulson was on Anchorage Street corner when she was approached by Hansen. When she agreed on price with him, he asked for oral sex and she got into his truck. While she was going down on him, she looked up and saw a barrel of a 0.357 Magnum looked back down at her. And then Robert produced a pair of handcuffs from underneath his seat and snapped them on Cindy's wrist. Hansen would brag later that he had gotten good at the process of handcuffing women at gunpoint. He had way too much practice. And then he drove Cindy to his actual home. He's more reckless now. Maybe part of him wants to get caught. Maybe he's just getting cocky. Thinks he can just take these girls to actual house and still not get caught. He forced Cindy inside and then he was dragged down to basement. And once there, she saw all those trophy mounts on the walls. Robert then handcuffed Cindy naked to a pillar in the center of the room and was repeatedly raped, sodomized for hours. And then he casually took a nap. After 5 hours in Hansen's basement, Cindy had to relieve herself, but Hansen was asleep. He had warned her not to wake him up. And of course, she was in chains. She had to pee on the towel that was sitting within her reach on the couch, a towel with potential now to become the evidence. When Robert finally woke up, he made Cindy to get dressed, then re-handcuffed her and drove her to the Merrill Field Airport, where he pulled up alongside his small blue and white aircraft. On the way there, Robert told her that they were going to fly up to his cabin in his Alaskan wilderness. Told her that he had taken lots of girls up there for fun. Cindy saw her chance to escape as they arrived at the plane and the hunter got out. She pushed through the driver's door and ran towards the lights of Fifth Avenue. As she ran, she could hear Hansen shouting, Stop, you bitch, stop or I'll kill you. Cindy never looked back. As she reached the road, she saw a truck's headlight approaching her and waved it down, still in handcuffs. The driver, 36-year-old Robert Hunt, slammed on his brakes and Cindy jumped into the truck screaming, "It's going to kill me." Hunt sped up off the truck and, instructed by Cindy, he took her to the Mush Inn motel. When he got there, Cindy demanded to be let out. Hunt drove on to where he worked and then immediately called the police. Sergeant Glenn Ford said, if Yont hadn't called the police, Cindy would not have reported it. Yont, through a phone call, put Hansen back into the police community. Need more good citizens. We can't do it alone. Officer Greg Baker of Anchorage Police Department was called to the room 110 of Big Timber Motel. When he entered the room, he came upon deeply agitated Cindy Paulson, her hands still secured in front of her with the handcuffs. She had single demand, get these handcuffs off my wrist. He did. Then he took Cindy to the hospital to complete the sexual assault exam. The examinations revealed the vaginal bruising and shackles marks around her neck and wrist, collaborating her story being abducted. She was then taken to Anchorage Police Headquarters to be interviewed. Cindy managed to give the police the detailed descriptions of Robert's house, car, plane and looks. It did not take the police long to find him. Officer Greg Baker of Anchorage Police Department was finally making it. When he entered the room, he came upon deeply agitated Cindy. Overall, Hansen was cooperative when he was found and did not demonstrate any characteristics that his guilt, although he was strangely calm for someone falsely accused. Hansen gave a detailed account of his movements, claiming that his wife and family were away in Europe, that he had been with his friends John Smurl and John Henning at the time he was accused of raping Cindy. Both men, when interviewed, did back up his story. Hansen readily agreed to the police searching his house, car, plane, and signed waivers agreeing to this. When police searched this, it became clear from the Cindy's detailed descriptions that she had been inside the house and car at some time. However, once again, it came down to whatever he said or she said. The word of a respected local businessman, this time with an alibi against the word of a prostitute with a police record. And then, upset that police didn't just believe her over Hansen, Cindy refused to take lie detector test, and that convinced William Dennis to close the case. However, Officer Greg Beckerman, the police who had taken Cindy's complaint, did still believe her. Thank God. And he kept thinking she was telling the truth. Keeping Hansen in mind, as more women went missing, wanting to catch him around this time, Anchorage investigators received an FBI profile on a man killing these prostitutes. The profile said that the killer would be an experienced hunter with low self-esteem, have a history of being rejected by women, and would feel compelled to keep souvenirs of his murders, such as victims' jewelry or even body parts. The profile also said that the man would be likely in his 40s and married to a woman who was deeply religious and oblivious to his crimes. Obviously, Hansen fit this profile perfectly. On September 2, 1983, 3 months after the rape and kidnap of Cindy Paulson, a third grave was found on the banks of Nicknow River. The victim was identified as another missing topless dancer, this time 17-year-old Paula Godling. Paula had been murdered in the exact same way as Sherry Morrow and had been redressed after death. Officer Greg Baker, still convinced Hansen was their man, looked into the Hansen's background and personal life back in the days before internet database made it so easy. Hansen eventually found a paperwork on Hansen revealing that the prior convictions and prior charges against him. And then the Butcher Baker case set legal precedent 1983, when psychological profiling was used as the main basis for issuing search warrant on Hansen's property. A report detailing Greg Baker's suspicion and copy of Hansen's criminal record was sent to St. Glenn Floth of Alaska State Troopers, who was heading the Topless Dam Search Task Force. Floth agreed that Hansen should be considered a suspect, and he began his own investigation into Hansen's. The more he learned, the more he became convinced he had found the killer, and Floth decided to reopen Cindy Paulson's case in an attempt to obtain evidence against Hansen. Sergeant Floth put in a shitload of work into determining Hansen had to be the guy. The muscle inside his skull working overtime for weeks and weeks to do what an investigator with a computer now can do in minutes. Floth conducted a systematic review of the state's missing person data slowly and methodically. He developed a matrix of possible serial murder victims, one that included pictures of women, their files, the dates that were last seen, and anything else included that would be coming up. If it fit, it went on the list. Classic old school detective work you have seen in so many true crime movies. I love it. It was tedious work, Floth would later state, sorting through these disruptive lives. There were women who had fought with these abusive lovers and presumably left town for good, leaving nothing but a few darkened 1-minute photos behind. There were teenager runaways, some missing one night and found the next, many others cast adrift to become known as from what this tragic assemblage. Floth was able to compile 8 similar cases. What Floth was looking was a pattern. He found it, with one exception. The victims were in their 20s. They ranged in the height from 5'4 to 5'7, weighed about between 120 to 125 pounds, and were slim and usually busty. Whoever was kidnapping or killing this young woman had a definite type. And when Cindy Paulson's file came across his desk, Floth immediately saw that she fit this pattern. She too was the killer's type. Floth re-interviewed Hansen's friends, Henning and Smurl, about Hansen's alibi and informed them that he was threatening to charge them with perjury. The threat worked. Both men admitted they had lied to help Hansen out of what they thought was an embarrassing domestic situation. When both men had redacted their statements, an order was issued for Hansen's arrest. Investigators followed Hansen to his bakery and asked him to come to police station for questioning. When he was arrested, Hansen never even bothered to ask why they wanted to talk to him and agreed to go along. At the Anchorage Trooper Station, Sergeant Floth had stage managed an interview room following pointers from the FBI. Hansen was placed in an interview room that had been carefully set up for this exact interrogation. There were maps of Nickna River along with the vaults and pictures of gravesites, victims on the desks. There were files and folders with the names of Hansen's family, friends, acquaintances, and so on them. Robert was intentionally left to sit in the room alone for a while in an attempt to make him uncomfortable. Let him look at the maps and pictures. Let it sink in that they fucking had him. They watched him through a 2-way mirror. A few minutes later, Floth and Sergeant Daryl Gillan entered the room and began an interview with Hansen that would last for 5 whole hours. Whilst Hansen was being interviewed, a team of officers was searching his house and plane. They found weapons throughout the house, but not the weapon they needed to implicate Hansen in any of the murders. Towards the end of interrogation, after all this work, it was starting to look like Hansen might get away with it all again. But then, right before calling it a day, one of the officers searching Hansen's home discovered a hidden space tucked away in attic rafters behind some wooden paneling in his trophy room. Police found items of cheap jewelry, more trophies that would soon be traced to back his dead victims. Among the significant items, Hansen had kept a fish necklace that had been custom made for victim Andrea Altria. There were also newspaper clippings, a driver's license, and various ID cards, of some of which belonged to dead men. And then police found the most damning evidence of all, the Ruger Mini 14 hunting rifle Hansen had used to kill multiple women. It was hidden under some floorboards. Ballistics testing would soon prove that this gun that killed Sherry Morrow and others, and then the Sherry evidence Sunday. Investigators found an aviation map of Anchorage region dotted with 20 drawn asterisks. Hansen's ex, three of these corresponded with the sites where bodies had already been found. Hansen, of course, initially denied any connection with the murders. But when confronted with the wealth of evidence against him, he decided to confess. He admitted that the asterisks on the map were the grave sites of the prostitutes that he had murdered. And then Hansen told investigators that he hadn't killed every girl he had taken up into wilderness, as if that made him a decent dude, as if they would understand that he'd only kill the bad ones. He claimed that he only wanted oral sex, and if the girls complied, they were flown home. No big whoops, all in good fun. And then he told them that if they resisted, if they rejected him, then he'd force them to strip at gunpoint and make them run. These naked and afraid women would usually be given a head start, and then Hansen would stalk and hunt them like an animal. Sometimes the sadistic fuck would allow them to think they'd escaped, and then track them down, capture them, rape them again, and then make them run again. This would continue until they were too cold and exhausted to continue running, and then he would shoot and kill them. Horrible guy. On November 3, 1983, an Anchorage grand jury returned four indictments against Hansen. They were first-degree assault and kidnapping, five counts of misconduct in possession of handgun, theft in second degree, and theft by deception in insurance fraud. His bail was set at $500,000, and don't worry, more charges are coming. On November 20, 1983, ballistic test results came back from the FBI crime lab in Washington, D.C., and officials determined the shell casings found at the gravesite had been all fired from Hansen's rifle. The firing pin, the extractor markings were identical. On February 1984, Hansen pled guilty to four counts of first-degree murder in cases of Paula Goodling, Joanne Messian, Sherry Morrow, and Iclona Annie. Hansen had his defense attorney, Fred Dewey, arrange a meeting with Anchorage DA Victor Crum. During the meeting, Crum offered Hansen a deal. In exchange for full confession, prosecutors guaranteed Hansen that he would only charge with four cases that he knew of, and that he would probably be able to serve his time in federal facility rather than a maximum security institution. The deal was also stipulated that the press wouldn't be involved, which I think is how Hansen's kids had been able to, you know, they were kept out of the papers. After both sides signed off the agreement, Hansen gave police a 12-hour confession during which he admitted to killing 17 women and burying them, their remains, in the wilds outside Anchorage. Here is Hansen describing one of his typical abductions. Quote, "I pull out the gun. I think the standard speech was, look, you're a professional, you don't get excited. You know there is some risk to what you have been doing. If you do exactly what I tell, you are not going to get hurt. You're going to count this off as a bad experience and be a little more careful next time who you got another proposition to go out with. You know, I tried to act as tough as I could," he said, "to get them as scared as possible. give that right away, even before I started taking at all. Reach over, you know, and hold that head back and put that gun in her face and get them to feel helpless, scared. Right there, I'm sure, maybe it's not the same procedure for you. You always try to get control of the situation, so same some things don't start going bad. Or maybe I have seen some cops show on TV, I don't know. Okay, Hansen also indicted that he began killing as early as 1973. Hansen told investigators that once he had victim under his control and up in the woods near his remote cabin, hunting them was like going after a trophy doll sheep or a grizzly bear. For a little more insight into the mind of Hansen, here's a portion of confession to the DA Victor Crum. Why did you drive out the road instead of just going to a hotel or a motel in the town? Hansen answers, you know, if you go to a hotel or something with it, it's more or less likely like a prostitution deal I'm going. And I guess I'm trying to even convince myself that I wasn't really buying sex. It was being given to me in the aspect that I was good enough that it was being given to me. If I can explain that a little bit gentler, better like a gentleman, going back in my life, way to my high school days and so forth, I guess what you might call very frustrated, upset all the time. I would see my friends and so forth going on dates and so forth, going on tremendous desire to do the same thing. From the scars and so forth on my face, you can probably see, I could see why girls couldn't want to get close with me. When I'm nervous and upset like this, if I try to demonstrate, I think I can about how exactly I'm going to say, and if I talk slow, I keep myself stuttering. But at the time, during my junior high school and high school days, I could not control my speech at all. I was always so embarrassed and upset with the people making fun of me, and that I hated the word school. I guess this is why I burned on the bus way back in Iowa. I remember going up, talking to someone, man or woman, classmate or whatever, and start to say something and start to stutter so badly that especially in the younger years, I would run away crying, run off someplace and hide for a day or so. The worst there was that the rebuttal of all the girls around the school was so forth. The jokes, if I could have faced it, I don't know if I could have faced it and laughed along with them, it would have stopped, but I couldn't at all. And it's just so that controlled me and I didn't control it. When he was sentenced, Judge Moody, citing Mr. Hansen's previous records of abductions and either attempted or actual rape of prostitutes, said regarding of how our culture views prostitutes, he says, I cannot think of a bigger indictment of society than we have here. This gentleman here has been known for several years. He said, we have turned him loose several times. Prostitutes had complained about how Hansen had treated them long before he was apprehended, but the police had doubted their credibility because of their profession. Assistant District Attorney Frank Rothschild added, three of the four murders Mr. Hansen pleaded guilty to were committed in the period that he would have been in prison had he served the full 5 years. Rothschild also told the judge, quote, before you sit a monster, an extreme aberration of human being who has walked amongst us. Not even his wife of 20 years had any inkling of his dark evil side. His crimes numb the mind, unquote. In 1988, Hansen became one of the first inmates in new maximum security Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward. He was moved there because it was discovered that Hansen was collecting materials including aeronautical maps that indicated he was planning to try to escape from Lemon Creek. After 2 years of having her children harassed At school, Mrs. Hansen filed for divorce from Robert. Can't believe she waited 2 years. She moved with their two kids to lower 48 states and I'm guessing changed their names. No in Hansen's family ever contacted him again. On 21st August 2014, Robert Hansen finally passed away. He died at the age of 75 at Alaska Regional Hospital in Anchorage due to undisclosed lingering health conditions. So, the next time you want to commit crime or get into a car with a stranger, think again. It's not good. Keep listening to Crime with Kay. And remember, not to pop up as an episode on my podcast.